Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously, and the podcast about rugby that, in addition to being there for you 52 weeks of the year, without fail, every Monday morning, also the rugby podcast that cares deeply, passionately about local rugby matters, something we're bringing to life right now in a special, which, before I introduce our special guest, I'll just explain it like this. I sent many pictures back from the Rugby World Cup in 2023. The one that basically got any sort of reaction from JB and Phil was the one that I sent when I sent a picture, because I was sat watching a game in Marseille in that opening weekend next to our special guest tonight. They were absolutely buzzing.
And gutted. We got gutted that we missed it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Finn Russell, not so much, but Charlie Morgan, 100%. Charlie, welcome to the show.
What an introduction. Thank you very much for having me, and thank you very much for that selfie as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been saying to the boys for a long time, it's about time that the world's best rugby journalist was on the world's best rugby podcast.
Wow. No pressure then. This is you've caught me on the way back from Bristol. I've been out of there with trains, but let's get some magic happening.
Exactly. Well, you wrote quite the article this week, so why don't you just, I guess, start with telling us what made you think of this, because we absolutely loved it, and just give us an introduction to what the article does.
It was an attempt to delve deeper into the world of sort of payments at lower levels, and I tried to kind of define lower levels as a community game, which is the same way that the RFU defines it, which is level three and down. And I know level three being national one, and that's quite high to be termed as a community game. And I know some clubs in that sort of bracket get pretty peeved by that, which is fair enough, to be honest.
Yeah.
But that made it a natural kind of category, I guess. And I actually was thinking about where this started, and it started at a wedding. It was a wedding of an old teammate for a club I used to play for that had gone up. When I finished playing for them, they'd gone up to level four, I think, so national two. And at the wedding, this chat was about how the side had started to get match fees in the last kind of year or so. And obviously, we were all gutted about that, because it was a similar sort of level as a level that we'd finished playing at. But that came to be a sort of sign of the times. Just having been around, played at that sort of level from sort of level seven to level four, that was always a chat, wasn't it? It was really, and what hit home doing the article and trying to speak to as many sources from around the country as possible was just sort of when a side does well or has been doing well for a few years, the accusation is straight away, must be paying brown envelopes, must be going everywhere. And what made it funner but also more tricky was that a lot of the time there's a bit of room, a bit of hearsay. The truth's mostly somewhere in the middle, whereby some clubs will be paying formally, some clubs will be paying a little bit recklessly, a little bit naughtily, and some who are doing really well haven't paid at all. And it was just really interesting talking about that, and the people that went on the record, really grateful to them. I think the most interesting stuff maybe was clubs who were sort of acknowledging that they would have to transition from being a club who hadn't played and were quite proud about that, to really thinking about it because of the competitiveness of the league they are in, the competitiveness over recruiting players. And it was just great. It was actually, it might maybe sound a bit sort of worthy, but it was really humbling speaking to people from clubs who are still getting their hands dirty in the community game, because I certainly didn't feel like when I played that I maybe appreciated the effort that people were going to organize things, and you know, you'll have a chat to them afterwards in the bar, but then you sort of take it for granted, I feel, and it was really nice in that regard to reconnect, if only a little bit.
Yeah, did you find that there was a difference in the frequency of payments across the country? So did you find that like there was one particular area of the nation where this occurs far more frequently? And the bit which you didn't mention in your article, but I'd love to know about, is do payer payments and their effectiveness, is it more a case of that is effective in like poorer areas or richer areas? Is there any sort of correlation like that?
So I would say one thing I found out both during the piece and afterwards, and the reaction it's got, is that I've barely scratched the surface, and this could be a book. And there are loads of different strands to it. I would say first, different areas certainly. The kind of common strand was that clubs that are kind of in maybe a little cluster. So I speak to myself, having played in South West London. When I moved down to South West London, what I found was really interesting, which was really alien to me, having grown up in East Midlands and around Leicestershire, was that everybody had played for four clubs. Everybody had sort of played for Roslyn Park, Esher, Wimbledon, and had sort of dotted between those and had moved around. And so speaking to people up in Lancashire, they're sort of, I mean, terms like arms race, you know, were used over sort of kids 14, 15 who were getting spoken to by people attached to first teams, saying, you know, in a couple of years you might be moving through Colts and this is what you might be able to earn as a match fee in the first team. So I'd say, yeah, clubs that are in and around sort of that have got clusters around them, that would be where they were fairly frequent. And then we texted about this as far as the kind of different social areas and social demographics and the effectiveness of payments. One really interesting thing that came up was, so somebody spoke to me anonymously from a club who there was a bit of tension in across the club because the first team had been getting paid and the second team weren't. And Tuesdays and Thursdays were sort of this shop window for selection. Yes. But actually what was happening was that a lot of people in the second team were not making themselves available for the first team and vice versa, either because of the animosity and not wanting to be associated with the first team, who'd had a bit of a trickier time in terms of results, or because they didn't want to pay it. They didn't want to make themselves available if it was only going to be for the second team, and therefore they weren't going to be able to be paid. What I didn't think of, loads of things came up that I didn't think of, but one thing I didn't think of in this instance was that what was causing people to want to be more available for the paid stuff was that they were on, they were students, they were sort of apprentice teachers, and they yes. really needed that extra income. So they weren't necessarily from the more deprived areas, but they needed the income because of the stage they were at in their lives. So yeah, that was, yeah, just so many different strands came out of it, and so many different, different kind of talking points, I guess. But one thing I'm trying not to be, having spoken to a close mate who's still playing in National One, I sort of came to it, I guess, maybe slightly sanctimoniously, going, is it a bit ridiculous that players are getting paid to play in the third tier? And he went, mate, shut up, for one. Secondly, look at how much travel there is involved in this league. Look yep. at the, yeah. the look at the quality of it. Look at the commitment it takes. And why not, basically, it being in the third tier. So that was very early on.
Just on one thing you said there, Charlie.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing about the training sessions on a Tuesday and Thursday being a chance to whack first teamers. I mean, I have been
amazing.
There.
Yeah.
I have been there time and time again. And yeah,
I vividly remember towards the end of, my career, losing my place and just being a prick training against the first team, sort of mouthing off at the coach who'd be refereeing.
You're trying to ruin every line out. You're trying to win every scrum.
Yeah, steel sharp and steel.
Yeah, exactly right.
That article was, well, I mean, for one thing, two of my two clubs, basically.
Yeah, was that correlation or causation? Do you just go to the highest payer?
Well, you see, Phil and I have both got a very similar story in that the club that we played mini rugby at from the age of six, we ended up playing for the first team, and it just so happened the club we were at, Newbury in my case, and in Phil's case, it was Sedgley Park, were both at level three at the time. And I mean, I was so proud to pull on that shirt. And actually, the sort of flip side of this, and you're so right in what you say, Charlie, and what you highlighted, and how humble you felt chatting to people. The people involved in local rugby are amazing, but when money gets involved, it can't help but muddy that. And I saw that. I mean, I wasn't at Newbury when the plug was pulled on the cash and it dropped down the leagues. I was at Manchester when the money was.
Yeah, you were, weren't you?
And they dropped down and instantly. And I cared a lot about Manchester. My brother had played for that club. I'd come up north to work, and that's the club I wanted to play for. I felt like I had an attachment to it, and the money went, and instantly. I remember Dave Baldwin, the coach, great coach. He came in and went, "That's it, lads.
It's done.
It's done." And within a couple of days, the squad had scattered to the winds. Some had gone to Macclesfield, Sedgley Park.
Well, I guess that goes to the point of Charlie's story, which is like it's the clusters, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
So,
well, I was playing at Sedgley Park at that time, and I think there was rumours that season. So they folded, or the money stopped about the Christmas time.
Yeah,
and that year, so in the kind of the summer window, the pre-season, there was probably three or four players had come from Manchester to Sedgley, and then. At that Christmas or January, there was another six, seven in it, or eight. And then some went to Mac, some went to probably Coldy, some went to Preston, name checked in the story, some went to Fylde. So you had all these guys who were able to play at that level, and they just got distributed. All of the second team, the Manchester second team, who were
And Colts as
and
well.
Well, it got down to the real bare bones, but... Immediately, all the second team who were good club lads and good players, because they were a second team who were probably equivalent of, say, a Broughton Park first team at that...
Level six, level seven.
At that era, yeah, they all stepped up, but were just having 50, 60...
100.
Points. Well, yeah, it started off by 50, 60 points, and then a load of guys said, well, I'm not travelling 8 hours... down to
Redruth
or six times a season to go and to play Ealing or Richmond or London Scottish, like to travel to London. And so it got to 80, 90, 100 points a week.
The tragedy of this, right, was... Sorry about this, Charlie.
No, keep going. It's really interesting.
Yeah, get Charlie to come on the podcast to listen to our stories. the tragedy about this is we actually got two players with Broughton Park who were superb, and they were picking up £50 a game at Manchester. Even on the way down, they wouldn't stop paying. And they were two of our best players, a guy called Blake and a guy called Mark. Mm. Oh, you may remember Blake and Mark.
Yeah, I know.
And like... They were phenomenal. But prior to that, they were having a miserable time in rugby, getting paid 50 quid. And just as Charlie mentioned in his story, they were students. That's why they did it, because they were students. And there were a few students from Tarleton.
But I guess this is the push and pull, isn't it, Charlie? That exactly what you say, that you, as your mate at National One, and you know, Phil and I played for our hometown club, but we were like, oh, wow, look at us, we're actually earning a couple of quid while we're doing this. It's amazing, and you wouldn't want to stand in the way. But it does, the other end of that, The other side of that coin is that you don't have that attachment and that commitment, which is the absolute bedrock of what makes all of our local clubs.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, one thing that kept coming through from the club, and again, I feel a bit on edge describing a club as doing something well and sustainably, but the ones that did seem to be doing it fairly sensibly kept impressing the importance of what you said, Tim, right at the start of that, when you're talking about the pride you're feeling. And a lot of that comes from a core of people that have been there as juniors and have built that attachment over a lot of time. And then the second thing is that whether or not they were paying, just buy-in, and that kind of goes all the way through. I know it's Chasing the Sun 2 final premiering tonight, isn't it? And that's something South Africa did at the very, very top level, better than anybody. Just getting that buy-in, however you get it. That rugby's a fairly simple game in that regard. And the clubs that are doing that well, regardless of sort of their spending strategy, as it were, even at that level, seem to be doing really well, and success breeds success, which was a really good point made by the first club that I spoke to, which was Teddington, who have gone on having sort of had 10 years treading water, probably fair to say. Bob, who funnily enough, I've known since I was 8 years old, played mini rugby with Bob. So when somebody said this guy's getting paid 500 quid a game, it was a fairly easy one to fact check. I could just ring him up and say, what's the story, mate? But he remembers sort of playing for Teddington when they were scraping through and almost having to concede walkovers. And they're lucky because they're in an area of London that's fairly affluent. So they're kind of what they've now had this little pocket of success where they've managed to get guys who did minis and juniors at Teddington, went off to university, have come back to work in London, and now sort of populating that first team. Mm. They've got they're training once a week, which has proved really popular. So they're doing a lot of other things really well. But it's just really interesting whether money is involved or not. How clubs manage to sort of generate that success and generate that impetus, and all of it comes down to the same thing, which is just buy-in.
Did you get any examples of paying clubs, or clubs that pay, I should say, which you'd consider like good practice? And yeah, I'll give you an example. Broughton Park say that they never pay. They don't pay, but I know that money did change hands for some players, but in my mind, for completely the right reasons. It was players that had already played for us for a long time and they needed the money. If it was, for instance, the very important player who had to take shift work. And I think that's exactly how it should be done, actually. If you want to give away money, that's the kind of way, that's the way they should go about it. Or they assist with other things, expenses, that kind of thing. Did you encounter, I think we all know what bad practice looks like. What was the good practice that you encountered?
Yeah, again, really, the guys that were, so Rams have just finished second for the second consecutive year in National One, and their CEO, Gary Reynolds, spoke to me for, all of these interviews could have just gone on a lot longer, but this one was really interesting because he was talking about, he's saying, look, where we've been in and around National One, National Two for a while, we've seen clubs shoot past us and we've thought, right, okay, fine, that's fine for this season. They'll be back on their way back down. I'm sure of it, because what they're doing isn't sustainable. When they reckon that their playing budget was about £140,000 a year, which they seem to think, they're sort of joking about that being fairly low in National One. Mm. What they did say was that they supplemented that with a lot of support staff, so physios and a match day doctor. They very interestingly, I'm not sure whether they were the very first, but they have actually been done on the declaration forms. So that threshold, 140,000, is actually a fair way below what you're allowed to pay in National One annually. But they gaffed the form. They ticked the wrong, I think they literally ticked the wrong box. And that meant that they got a 5-point deduction in the COVID season that was curtailed. In National One, and they got another 5 points suspended, but they also lost. So the punishment for breaking these thresholds is you lose RFU benefits, which in their case were travel, and they also had to pay a little bit more towards referees that season. So I think they ended up costing them about another £8,000, which wasn't massively disastrous. It seemed to me, sort of speaking to Gary, that it was sort of more a little bit embarrassing because they prided themselves on being fairly squeaky clean and fairly transparent in that they weren't a big spending club, but they promoted their junior section. But yeah, so ironically, having fallen foul of the regulations, they would they struck me as an example of pretty good practice. Yeah.
And the flip side of that question then, what were the kind of most ridiculous, either because it was £800 a game at level eight, or I once knew a player who played at Birkenhead Park 20 odd years ago for his match fee was 8 pints and a takeaway.
That's class. Yeah, that's brilliant. The Gareth Lewis was really good at going on record and just sort of cataloguing what he'd seen in Yorkshire and how he'd seen, and this is an example of the clusters, right? So he'd seen players pack up and leave clubs over 20 quid per game difference in their contract. Gareth Dyer was really good in talking about how the transfer fee of £6,000 to move between two level five clubs blew my mind, to be honest.
That's
can you guess crazy. Can you guess what? I mean, I don't know what the level five clubs were, but can you guess what they are?
That wasn't one not a million miles from us, was it, in the northwest or the kind of Lancashire area, was it?
It's from Preston. If you think about the players that have left, it must have been Rosendale.
Yeah, and I think when I read that bit, I think I know the player as well.
I think I know the player too.
I won't say anything.
Good on him.
I don't know, that was those two clubs were named. Were named in the article, but Gareth was saying that he'd dug his heels in because they'd given these players were contracted, and when players were coming, when clubs were approaching them, they dug their heels in and sort of made sure that those contracts were honoured and I think, I hope I'm right in saying that, I think Preston raised £13,000 over about half a dozen of these transfers, level five. And that's
mad.
The sort of stuff that, yeah, blew my mind, to be honest. I was trying to kind of, maybe a follow could be to try and find sort of the lowest level that goes on. But then again, you don't want to, because of the player coaches, the clause and the thresholds that you can be paid below level six and below if you're a player coach, and there's sort of budget set aside in regulations to do that. And I know that clause, a lot of people feel that is taken advantage of, but I've played with player coaches who've been fantastic as well. So you kind of don't want to go pointing the finger, do you really?
But no, and I think the sweet spot here is, like, we're so grateful in rugby to the people that do bring wealth and money into it.
Absolutely.
Or the sponsors who, you know, invest their company's money into rugby clubs at whatever.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Or the children's inheritance.
Oh, exactly. So grateful for that. But to Charlie's point about getting that buy-in and that culture and all the things we love about rugby, and I've seen this at clubs, and you even touched on it in your article, Charlie, where talking about best practice, you can spend all that money, and it doesn't have to go directly into a player's pocket. Food after training.
Yeah, big one, isn't it?
We had cars at Newbury, which was amazing.
Cars?
Yeah, we had
cars?
Well, basically, I got told you can have a car. I was at Bath University, and they were like, you can have a car, but you just got to bring three lads from the room to come.
That's
and come
a great
and play.
Idea, in
as, long, as long as you fill the car up with lads from Bath Uni to come and play with us, they were happy. So that's what I did. But yeah, there's all sorts of ways. And just...
drinks after the match, food after training is the simplest way you could effectively hand money to players, but completely in an above board way, right, Charlie?
Yeah, totally. There was a club that didn't actually want to go on record to say that they did it in case. I don't know why they didn't, because it was a really cool story, but they actually have physical beer tokens that they give out to players after the game, which I thought was really cool. So just to touch on what you're saying straight away there, Tim, the absolutely agree with the point on the people bringing money into the game. And I tracked down, so East Grinstead, when I played for, Wimbledon, and East Grinstead were like this. It was like, the only way I could describe it was like we knew a shark was coming to get us, because they were just coming through the leagues, pumping everybody. And there were these rumours about how much they were paying, and they put out highlight reels. And eventually they sort of were in the same league, and they beat us twice. But there was all this chat about how much they were paying, had a lot of Kiwis paying for them. But I actually tracked down the sort of, but then they went, so they then sort of stalled or stayed put a couple of leagues, or one league above us. And we got promoted and win their league for a couple of years. And then Gavin Gleave, who was their chief sponsor at the time and director of rugby, left. So I managed to track him down for the article, which was great because, well, one, he insisted that they weren't getting paid as much as we were insistent that they were getting paid, obviously, because we were for our own sort of self-respect, saying that they must have been getting paid absolutely loads. But it was actually quite sad, because he'd sort of gone in, really successful businessman, had gone in with a, you know, really ambitious but reasonably kind of sound plan of wanting to just keep developing. Grinstead was in a very advantageous position, wanted to install a 3G pitch and then raise money with rentals of that. He said that he had a deal with Chelsea Football Club. He was going to rent it because it was so close to Gatwick Airport. He was going to rent it out to teams coming over, maybe to play in Europe, rugby teams. But then it sort of fell foul of sort of he had a few disagreements with the committee and walked away. So it actually looked from the outside like, right, East Grinstead have got to National 3. They haven't gone up for a couple of years. They've stopped this prodigious rise. Money Man's walked away, but actually getting in contact with him and sort of really listening to what he had to say and how passionate he was about it all and his plans for it. It was actually just really, really sad, to be honest, and kind of a bit indicative of rugby perhaps not being able to get as many of those sorts of people as it would like.
Yeah, Charlie, who was the RFU councilman that you got a quote off? I can't remember if you named him
the spokesperson at the end.
Yeah, the reason I ask is I can't remember if he went on as a named source.
The spokesperson was just a response from the union to the story. I'd sort of highlighted what sort of thing came up. The main sort of feeling, I guess, that they would have to respond to would just be that a lot of clubs felt that the RFU didn't have the resource to manage the kind of thresholds that they'd put up, and also that the post-COVID, the benefits that they did give to clubs, so for example, travel subsidies, weren't actually significant enough to dissuade clubs from breaking those thresholds.
Yeah.
So it was just a union kind of a communication. So I guess they would have gone to whatever department looks after that and got a response.
So, I mean, it's my opinion. I have no problem with anyone paying anyone anything. But I think there was a quote in there about, you know, rugby being in its middle ages now from one of the...
That was John Inverdale.
Yeah,
he was on the record, yeah.
To me, that just strikes of individuals not appreciating that every rugby club needs a different model, and very intelligent people deciding that they know best for everyone. And did you find that the RFU really did understand what the case on the ground is for paying players?
It's hard to say, really. I think they're definitely... So John was speaking there with that quote, I think, with his sort of chairman of the National Leagues hat on. And I think that the fear there So to answer the question, I think so. Yeah, I think they're aware that there's so many different sorts of clubs. And I think what you're getting at there is that is what John is saying is that something he said that I didn't use was that he'd like the same for somebody to, he said, like, you, I don't have any problem with players getting played. And in fact, he reinforced the message about National One being of such a high level of quality and requiring such commitment that they absolutely should get paid. But he would be very much in favour of the club's infrastructure, so facilities, getting as much money as being the first priority, or at least being a priority alongside people getting paid. I think what nudged my desk into allowing me to do this was the context of Jersey as well as the three Premiership clubs feeling as though overreaching on players then puts you in such a kind of perilous position if you don't have anything to fall back on and you don't in it. And if and I guess that out of the three clubs that went bust, that was probably fair to say most kind of apparent at London Irish, right? There was the rumours that sort of that was clearly what they prioritised more than anything is the players getting paid a lot and having a fairly big squad budget. But as we mentioned at the top there, Manchester, Newbury, there are so many examples of it just becoming unstable because that there's so much priority in paying players. So Mounts Bay was the one in Cornwall that was really, there was almost like this white whale. Like speaking to clubs who'd go, God, if you can get someone from Mounts Bay, that would be brilliant. Because I think they got 9 promotions in 11 years.
Wow, that's quite impressive.
And then, I think the story, I'll get this from somebody I know for sure, but they were sort of originally a offshoot of Penzance or a club down there, and then when it all kind of hit the skids, they were trying to kind of reattach to Redruth or something anyway, but that seemed fairly flimsy. And stories of kind of them racking up 100 points and opponents being sort of laughing at them saying that they'd be sacked in the morning and all of this, and all very messy but all kind of very unstable as well. And I think that's what the quote about the lack of kind of stability and immaturity as a professional sport was came from. But because the other side of it was that, and I'm not sure, I didn't have time really to look into this more carefully, but a lot of people seem to think that football did this a bit better. There was a sort of more clear delineation between professional and semi-professional and amateur, and a lot of that from coming from sort of minimum standards as you go up the league. So there's that sort of natural check on it all.
Well, I was going to ask how much you've looked into other countries, because one thing I became aware of with France, just as an example, is that every single club has to have a completely zeroed balance sheet at the end of every year, otherwise they're not allowed to participate.
This is a big Mark Evans point. He always talks about the financial regulator in France, no doubt.
Yeah, no doubt allowed.
That's the Premiership of trying to adopt that, aren't they? Sort of back to front, isn't it? And then they're before the season, their budgets have to be assured so that they're not going to do what the Premiership did a couple of years ago and lose clubs during a season and jeopardise everything that goes with that sort of scheduling wise.
The Premiership would have a long, long way to go to be kind of cost neutral given season.
Just pay the 200 million quid worth of debt back.
Yeah, never mind all the historic debt that's on there, mostly owed to the owners of each club. Yeah.
But just to say again, Charlie, I think what the article does brilliantly, as well as delving into a really interesting area, is just capture the thing we all remember, the thing we all love. There are people of proper substance at your local rugby club.
Yeah. Mm. Just a few last ones for me, Charlie. What was the reaction like from your article? I mean, I read some of the comments on the Telegraph comments section. But you know, in general, has it been? I actually had to sign up to read that article. I was furious. what's the reaction been like? Have you had any more subsequent stories?
Yeah. I mean, that's been the main reaction is clubs grassing up other clubs, which is really funny. But it's but then that is straight into the hearsay bit as well. What was quite funny. So shout out to Oxford Harlequins. So a source had been in the same league as them and had gone, well, they've pissed the league, so they've got to be paying right. And then three people that had read the article went, these guys aren't mentioned in the article, but shout out to us. Shout out to Oxford Harlequins because they've just won, I think they've just won Regional 1 Midlands, so going up to National 2, and they haven't paid. And So one source was from another club in London, funnily enough, who just said, have you spoken to Oxford Harlequins? Because they came to me before the start of the season just to kind of bounce some ideas. Budget wise, and I looked down at their budget and I said, yeah. So have you just left off player payments? And they said, no, we're not going to do that this year. We'll see how we go. And they won the league. They won the league, including Stourbridge, who are sort of fairly well established ex-National League side, which is great.
Fair play.
But yeah, I guess the main reaction is just more people talking about, as we're doing now, about the kind of history of this happening and how clubs have dealt with it over the years. And I've just found that really interesting. It's felt like I've been able to immerse myself back into that sort of scene where I've sort of been a bit detached from it for a while, I felt.
Well, my favourite part of the article was the juxtaposition between the press and director of rugby telling everyone how stressful it is managing players, he needs to do it, followed almost immediately by Ian Jackson of Tarleton saying, oh yeah, press and take our players all the time.
Yeah. Well, it felt like, I kept thinking of sort of a fish being eaten by a bigger fish being eaten by a bigger fish. And how that's relayed is, through what lens that all of those things are being relayed by, and then somebody commented on the article set on the website saying that he was a coach at under 12s or under 13s, and that you just get sort of guys rocking up to watch in inverted commas, but basically to kind of pick off who they want to bring to their club, but under 15s, and I remember that happening as well. So I in no way think that this is going to maybe, I don't think it's going to change behavior. It's just interesting. It's just sort of just a subplot of what actually goes on.
Well, it's interesting you say, it just made me think. So my son's team that I coach are under 16. They're in the Lancashire Cup final next weekend. Handy team. And I was chatting to some guys at our club at Broughton Park and just saying, I think there's an argument in a couple of years' time, just you could build the next 10 years of a club around one good junior team.
Yeah, you can. Mm. Yeah, no two as well.
Get them all in, keep them all together. But you're right, the market forces in this part of town where we are, there are so many clubs that are just going to be picking them off.
Just to hear a term like market forces about a junior rugby team,
you're right.
It's so interesting. So National 2... director of rugby said, what's the market for players? Just don't get it. And I was just thinking, I can't believe I'm having this conversation about a market of this. And he was saying, he that was the quote that was, is the market for a player, is the market value of a player just what the club next door is going to pay? I think, yeah, maybe there is.
Maybe there is a market.
Mm. Yeah.
Just out of interest, what were you with the infrastructure to go up rather than the payments to go up? Do you think the payments should be linked to infrastructure and to you as well, Phil?
No, I think it's, I would like to think that if anyone had the money to pay, that was what they would do. And just going back to it, I would think if you had great training facilities, a gym in-house that the players could use for free. I'm just thinking of me as a player.
Like Aylesbury.
Aylesbury's a great example of a good local club.
No, I'm Marlow that pay.
They have a gym that they've built there that players can use. And I know I love this at Newbury, that there was the gym there, there was food after training, and all of that stuff, and great facilities. And that makes a massive difference in your week to week, doesn't it, Phil?
Yeah. So
I think that is by far the best way to build the foundations for success before payment. But I wouldn't want to kind of legislate or codify that. Because
well, just remember,
fooling his money soon parted.
But is it just? Is it just willy waving the money and sending someone up through the lease? Unless you're going all the way to the top, it's to what end?
Well, to what end? I mean, you know, you talk about infrastructure and clubs, and you know, what about the Barbarians? I mean, the most iconic club in the world has zero infrastructure. So I'm happy for them to build it however they want. And like Phil says, you know, a fool and his money are easily parted. If you want to spend a lot of money on paying a lot of players to play on a local park pitch with no change rooms, be my guest. I'm more than happy for you to do it.
Yes, but it's a foolish way to spend your...
Not my money, not
your
my
children's inheritance.
Excellent.
Is the article... the Telegraph is well worth the subscription. Is it still behind the wall? Will it make an appearance?
It is. I can have a word with it. It's above my pay grade, unfortunately. I can have a word.
Is anything above your pay grade at the Telegraph?
Good, as we've just been discussing, like quality things deserve to be paid for.
Exactly. Yes. Right.
Sustainably.
Absolutely agreed. So get your subscription. And go and check out Charlie's fantastic writing, not just on this article, but on rugby in general.
Just one last thing before everyone goes. I think this is probably the best way to do it. I'm going to ask you all the same question, including Charlie. Do you remember the first time you got paid? The first time you got paid for rugby, whether it be expenses or match fee, Charlie?
Oh, really? Well, yeah. It was a train ticket back to play for Oakham Town, and I picked up the money from the director of rugby, walked back to my seat in the bar and felt like the man. Yeah.
It does have that effect. Tim?
Yeah, I remember being paid. I signed a contract after I'd already played my first team game. I was playing for my hometown club. My family were all there. I was just on cloud nine anyway. And then found out I was getting paid after I'd already played. I didn't know I was getting paid until after.
Yeah, I can't imagine what Phil did with his first paycheck. Invested.
Because you would have been Sedgley Park as well. Did you sign terms and stuff before you played for the first team?
No, so it was about 4 or 5 games into the season. So I was 21, just come back from university, done pre-season, but was playing for the twos and was scoring tries for fun in a very good twos team, and got told that there's a couple of injuries. And so got told I was playing against, I think it was Doncaster, away for my first game.
I made my new debut against Doncaster.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And got told, Jeff Roberts, the kind of team manager, told me what I was going to get paid for it. And I was like, are you joking? That's amazing.
What was
that
it? What was
absolutely
the money?
Unbelievable.
What was the money?
It was 150 quid.
What?
Nice.
With 100 quid win bonus. And we didn't win many games in that year.
Did you win that one?
We did not win that
one. I got
150 quid is like, how old are you?
21.
That's awesome, isn't it?
Long time ago.
Was 25 quid a session for training, Tuesday, Thursday. So.
Yeah, nothing of that. So
25 quid for training, and it was, I was got 50 quid appearance, as long as you played 20 minutes or more.
Okay.
And then 100 quid. And then 100
what a great story.
And then 100 quid if you win. And it, towards when the money was getting tight at Newbury, there were loads of players pissed off, you'd go on after 61 minutes.
Yeah. Sorry, I've got to tell this story and then I'll let everyone go. And I can tell the story because neither of these players play. And if they do, it's not important enough to worry about. So Tom Brady effectively fell out with... Who was the Arscott boy at Sale?
Luke Arscott.
Tom at Sale.
No, was it Tom? Yeah. So the agreement was that Tom would pull a hamstring at a certain time in the game because Brady was one appearance off getting his bonus. So it goes like from 45K to 50K. And Arscott, reneged. He didn't come off. He said he was like rubbing his hamstring a bit, like he's a tiny bit injured, but never actually pulled the trigger.
Oh, gutted.
Oh. Excellent. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
What's the next article? What journalism are you deep into at the minute? Can you tell me?
I'm not sure I'm deep into it. I was was at Bristol today. So, and they've, I guess it's because I haven't been paying attention probably, but they've snuck into top four. So something like that. And they kicked the ball four times in the whole game.
Is that right?
And they're only playing, they're only playing Newcastle, but they sort of back to what they were doing in the real Galactico days a bit, and they're looking quite good. So just basically how they've hit a bit of momentum. I'm going to find quite interesting, I think.
And I was saying on the other pod, Bernard Jansi van Rensburg is a serious player, isn't he?
Very good. Qualifies for England in 2026.
There you go. That answers the thing we were talking about on the pod.
That's right. That's why he's the best in the business.
Top man, Charlie.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers. Cheers, lads.
Bye.
Fantastic. Right, there you go. If you appreciate the podcast, patreon.com/eggchasers. You can help keep the lights on, help make sure we get great content like that, and let the boys end.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.